Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am also doing great. I want to give a shout-out to Sally. It's been just a couple of weeks, I believe, that she's been out of the chat room, and her presence is missed when she's not there. So
I don't think Sally had bandwidth for both us and the World Series at the same time. I believe that's what's going on there. So that's all been resolved, and, you know, until Super Bowl season, I think we'll have her back with us. So that's you know, it's good to have my voice back. I was a little weak voiced last week, so I, you know, feel good doing the show from home rather than on the road. And what a great show we had last week, huh? Wasn't it terrific talking with Sonia about her book?
She is a great guest. We've had her on the show. Was that the third time last week?
At least the third time, possibly fourth, but yeah. I think third, yeah.
And every time, she's always interesting. That may have been the first time it was just her and she wasn't a member of a panel or something. And it was fun to get to just visit with her. She's got this new book out that's awesome, 100 plus. Phil and I have both enjoyed it. We highly recommend it. I don't think I'm speaking out of turn, Phil, am I?
I gave it pretty glowing recommendation last week, if you'll recall. I'm a big fan of the book, and I hope it's a tremendous success. It appears to really be taking off for her, and I think that's great. I think that it's a completely accessible introduction to the subject of what happens in the world when people start living longer and why are the, you know, what are the causes behind that. And it's an important book because it's reaching a much broader audience, I think, than that subject has gotten to before. And it's doing it in a way that I think people can get their head around and really start internalizing this issue and thinking about it. But, you know, we needed, I don't know what, at least another hour with Sonia, I think, to do that discussion justice last week. And that's why this week we're going to pick right back up where we were, and we're going to continue talking about that, along with a few other ancillary topics, and including the one that gave our show its title tonight, which is our 7 billionth customer, talking about the arrival of the 7 billionth human on the planet. But before we get into that, anything interesting going on in your life that you want to spend a couple minutes on?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it qualifies as something in my life, but I'm very much enjoying the Steve Jobs biography. It is really, really good. I can't recommend it highly enough. And I've only read a couple of chapters, so I don't have a lot to say just yet. But, Phil, grab a copy or download one on your Kindle or whatever, and it ought to be a subject of a future show. You know, Steve Jobs, interesting character, and surrounded by many other interesting people. So,
for sure. Who's the author?
Erickson.
Let me see.
I might have
to. So this came out after his death, or I guess maybe they were waiting to release it until he, or is it just coincidental that it was written around this time?
They moved it up.
I see.
The scheduled release date was going to be, I believe, the first quarter of next year, I believe. And then when he passed, they rushed it up and got it out. And interesting. He tell you who this author is. He's well known for a biography of Benjamin Franklin, and then he did Einstein after that. And then Steve Jobs is on his phone saying, I want you to do my biography. And the author thinks to himself, does Steve see himself as next in the line of Benjamin Franklin, Einstein, now Steve Jobs. And, Steve Jobs had did not suffer from a lack
of self-regard. No, he didn't.
Yeah,
he did not have self-esteem issues, no.
He did not. And, in fact, what's so great about this biography is that, it was made with completely with Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs cooperated in every way, but it's also warts and all. It's like Steve Jobs said, okay, here's my life. I want everybody, I'm going to be dead in a few months. I want everybody to know everything about me, good, bad, ugly, beautiful, the whole package, and that makes it a whole lot better of a book, if we had a plaster Saint Steve, that would be boring as all get out, right? But it's not that way at all. He's actually quite a jerk a lot of the time, and still manages to be this great benefactor of humanity. So, it's very interesting. Very interesting. So
yeah, when you talk about that lineup, Ben Franklin, Einstein and Steve Jobs, those aren't actually, I think he may well prove to be a historical figure of comparable stature to either of them, but the person that I would think of would be like Edison. To me, he's like a Thomas Edison figure. He's like a Henry Ford figure, right?
Right.
One of these people who just really
Henry Ford. Maybe a little P.T. Barnum thrown in there too.
P.T. Barnum thrown in there, and
yeah,
and Edison and Ford both notorious jerks, right? I mean, just, not known for being nice people at all, right? But but contributed hugely to shaping the world that we live in today. And Steve Jobs, to me, it's, I was talking to my wife about this, and she said, yeah, he's kind of like, when you think about the role he played in inventing the personal computer, for crying out loud. I mean, forget all the other stuff that came later. He's kind of like this Alexander Graham Bell figure. And I said, yeah, if Bell had invented the phone and then the radio and then the TV, right? Because I mean, that's right. That's Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, he kept coming back and adding to the legacy. So I don't think it's at all out of line for someone to suggest that somebody who wrote the biography of Ben Franklin and Albert Einstein to write Steve Jobs' biography, and it's just totally appropriate that it was Steve Jobs who made the suggestion. That's completely in keeping with who he was.
And so, he kept putting him off. Do check it out. Interesting. The author kept putting this off. Steve, I'll do your biography later. I'll do your biography later. When you've retired and you've mellowed out a little bit, for crying out loud. You need to mellow so I can, so you'll tell me the good, the bad, and the ugly. And finally, it was Steve's wife that intervened and said, "Look, if you're going to do a biography with Steve's cooperation about his life, you need to get on it."
Right.
And and on a sadder note, but anyway, just interesting, fascinating book. Got to read it. So, just with a couple of chapters under my belt, I can already recommend it highly.
Okay, well, I'm gonna definitely check that out, and if not next week, sometime in the near future, we can get into that. Well, speaking of edifying reading, I was very pleased that a big publishing event occurred on August 31st. And you and I were talking about it before the show started, so I won't quiz you as to what it was. But August 31st was my birthday, and we did a show that night, or a show that aired that night. But it was also a big event in the publishing world. It was the reboot of DC Comics. They started a series called The New 52, and they have rebooted the entire DC universe. And so they started numbering over, I couldn't believe this, even Action Comics, which I think never quite made it to issue number 1,000, or did it?
I'm not sure. But, I mean, Action Comics, predates Superman as a character.
Action Number 1 was the first appearance of Superman. It's Detective Comics that predates Batman, yeah, because it was...
okay.
We are deep into nerd territory now, because it was Detective number 27 that had the first appearance of Batman. But in fact, yeah, Detective, when they restarted at number one, not everyone knows that DC actually stands for Detective Comics, that the brand is named after after that comic book, which did in fact predate any of those heroes. So it's been really interesting reading these comics, and you and I were discussing. I guess you've been reading some of them too.
Yeah, I've read three of the reboots: Action Comics number one, Detective Comics number one. Which, man, that was a creepy Joker episode.
For sure. Yes, I read that yesterday. Yes.
Yeah. Let's see what else. Animal Man, just because it was, I don't know, I have no idea what Animal Man is, and
that's
so
such
a
cool name, like
yeah.
Animal Man.
So I just
find me
that
out.
In there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've been enjoying it. And are you reading it on paper, Phil? Are you?
I am.
Reading?
I was toying with doing them online, but there's to me, I'm not ready. I'm not ready to read comics on my iPhone. I don't have a Kindle or anything yet, right? So it would be on that small little screen, and there's still a tactile experience for comics with me.
There is something almost animated about experiencing a comic on an iPad. The experience is almost like, you know, once you get into it a little bit, it's almost a little bit like just watching a cartoon or seeing an animated episode of, Batman or something. But it's a different kind of deal because when you tap the screen, it kind of goes to the next panel. And, if it's like a full screen shot and you've got, dialogue all over the screen, it'll go, it'll shift from dialogue to dialogue. And then once you hit it the last time, it zooms out and you see the whole picture. And there's something really cool about that.
I got to check that out. As soon as I get an iPad, I'll probably give that a try and enjoy that. And that is the right way to go, because if you buy it both online and the print copy, then you can keep your print copy pristine, right? It can be mint condition, and
exactly, you can enjoy
and,
the
you know,
story.
As a collector's item, it accelerates in value. I mean, it's much much greater value for that. So anyway, I've been reading these, and I note that the writers of DC Comics have made the characters in DC Comics aware of things that readers have been saying for years, and it's just so much fun. I'm going to lay out a couple spoilers on Justice League. It's not major plot spoilers. It's just some fun stuff that happens in the first couple issues of Justice League, and I got such a kick out of it. Now the first two, they're starting over. I mean, we're learning the origin of the Justice League, and it's a whole new story. And for those not familiar, the DC Comics universe is Superman and Batman, The Flash, the Green Lantern, Wonder Woman, etc. Okay, so it's not Spider-Man and all those guys. It's these kind of older, more traditional heroes. And the Justice League is when they all get together and they're this like superhero team. So in the continuity, the new continuity, Flash and Green Lantern are the first to meet, but that happens off stage. We don't see that. So the first two heroes, superheroes that we see meeting are Green Lantern and Batman. And they take an immediate dislike to each other. Green Lantern says something to Batman at one point, which is just classic. It's just so wonderful. He says, they're talking about what their next move is, and Green Lantern, he can do this, he can do that, he can do another thing. And finally, he's like fishing for Batman. What are you going to do? Trying to get to what are these bat powers that you have exactly, right? And finally, it comes out, and he says, so you're telling me all you are is a guy in a bat suit? That's the whole thing? how lame is that? And that's funny because that this is the sort of discussion that comic book readers have all the time, and it's so unfair to Batman because he can't make his argument, right? Because the argument back from a to a Green Lantern fan is, yeah, well, I'm the most realistic one, right?
Yeah.
He can't, in the comic, he can't say, well, I'm more believable than you, right? It's just, that's the, that's the defense of Batman. So later, Batman and Superman meet, and the whole group is together at this point. They're not all there. Wonder Woman's not part of it yet, but the ones I mentioned, Flash, Green Lantern, Batman, and Superman are all talking. And Batman is trying to explain to Superman how things are a bit different for the others than they are for him. And he says, well, for one thing, you obviously don't have another identity to protect since you're not wearing a mask like we do. And I just thought that was hilarious. You know, it's like, you know, clearly if you had a secret identity, you'd wear a mask, right? You idiot. No, you're just, you know, you're it's like, no, he's got a really clever disguise. He takes off his glasses, right? And he changes his hairstyle and changes clothes. Anyway, just one of those great things that people who read comics talk about, and the characters have never dared mention. Actually, that was the one thing I really liked in the movie Green Lantern, when Green Lantern flies up to his girlfriend, and she takes one look at him and goes, "Hal?" Right? She immediately recognizes who he is.
You're just wearing a mask around your eyes. It's easy to see who you are.
Says, I've known you my whole life. I've seen you naked. You think I'm not going to recognize you because you hid your cheekbones? That was exactly right, and it's so true. But it's things that characters in comics have never gotten to talk about before, and now they're starting to talk about it. So anyway, it's really fun to see the whole thing starting over in the new Action Comics. We got Superman as a young Superman, and then in Superman he's older. So we've got two timelines going on, which is interesting. And in the young Superman adventures, we were talking about this before. He hasn't figured the uniform out yet quite.
He's blue. All the colors are the same, but I mean, it's blue jeans, you know, for the pants.
Right.
You know, it's not.
And he's wearing like hiking boots, right? Or they're like
exactly.
They're like construction boots or something. They're not, you know, superhero boots. And the cape's really short. And it's just a T-shirt. It's just short sleeve T-shirt. And you look at it, and you go, okay, man, you really need to work on the uniform. I mean, in the story originally, I guess we'll find out later how he came to come, you know, to have this particular uniform. But originally, this was his mother made this uniform for him, and I don't think Ma Kent would have made that T-shirt, jeans.
It looks like something that a 20-year-old guy just threw together.
Exactly,
you know?
It looks like he came up with his own uniform, and I bet eventually he'll start wearing a uniform that his mom makes for him, and that'll be the new one he's wearing. Highly controversial. We were talking about this. And we'll leave it with the fact that it's a terrible shame and a great disgrace that they've removed Superman's red trunks. I think we can all agree on that point. And
okay,
we can move on.
You just
with the
sock
show.
Buffeted your co-host, yeah. You know, but
exactly. Well, you're the one with the mute switch, so you can always turn off. Oh, Sally asks if he's Superboy. He appears to be a transition from Superboy to Superman.
That's right.
But he is clearly Superman because he's all grown up and he's living in Metropolis, and the character
very young
of Lois
Superman
and he's the youngest Superman we've ever seen, I think. So anyway, enough about comic books. Let's get to our topic. I want to talk about the 7 billionth person arriving on the 7 billionth person arriving on the planet. So, what's your take, Stephen? Good news, bad news? How do you what's your gut response to the population of the world hitting 7 billion?
You know, everybody gets kind of freaked out a little bit by the new big round number. You know,
mm-hmm.
As if it really means something besides just the next number. There was a similar freak out when at 6 billion. When was that, Phil? How long ago has that been?
I believe 15,
20
11
years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we're here at 7 billion people, and you begin to hear talk. We're overpopulating the world, this and that. I'm going to tell you, I see it as nothing but a positive. And let me just give you one small reason why. 2.2% of the population are geniuses. That's
right.
Almost by definition. Anybody over the IQ of 140 is classified as a genius. And the way they have the IQ test set up is that 100 is always average, and then there's a certain distribution above and a certain distribution below. And so genius will always be 2.2% of the population. And let me put it to you this way. We now, because there's 7 billion people in the world, we now have 154 million geniuses in the world. And unlike, say, a genius living, 10,000 years ago, probably bored to death, I've invented fire. I've invented the wheel. You know, this is, you know, what else am I supposed to do? You know, sitting around a campfire somewhere, bored out of his mind. These 154 million geniuses, for the most part, can talk to each other and can collaborate. And so, you know, I'm not saying this to say that, you know, you have to be a genius to contribute anything to the world. I hope to contribute something to the world myself, and I do not count myself among the geniuses. But I'm going to tell you, the fact that there's that many brilliant people in the world, and that they can talk to one another and collaborate, and it's that's nothing but a positive. And so, you know, Phil, I see it as a great thing.
I could not agree with you more. Let me give my evidence that it's good news. And I refer to a story we've talked about numerous times over the last couple of years, and that is a study, a genetic study that was done a few years back that revealed that human beings almost became extinct 70,000 years ago. Now, how close did we come to being extinct? Well, you know, they're extrapolating from gene evidence, so you have to take this with a grain of salt.
One of the reasons they know this, Phil, is because how closely related everybody on Earth is to one another.
Right. It's an extrapolation, but it's based on some reasonable evidence, kind of like our estimate of 7 billion population, right? Because we really haven't counted. You know, it's like so.
Yeah, nobody came around my house and asked how many people I have in my house.
Exactly. So, if we're going to take one on faith, we'll take the other one, or not faith, but you know, reasonable. Reasonable credibility of the source, in this case the UN, who may have been as much as 2 years off on the 6 billion estimate. Some authorities have
said. Hey, I'm going to just say that one of your twins, Phil, is the 7 billionth one. I'm just going to go ahead and say
that. That's kind of how I was working it. Yeah, it's like the twins showed up, and I think they topped us off.
They put it over the top.
I would be perfectly fine with that, but anyway, so according to the evidence, we got down to 2,000 human beings. 70,000 years ago. 70,000 years ago is not that long ago.
No.
You know, important prehistory starts just 30, 40,000 years after that, and history begins, 60,000 years after that. I mean, so we're closing in on the window. This isn't like, you know, prehistoric. I mean, it is prehistoric times, but it's not like dinosaur times. It's not it's not like Homo erectus, you know, or Australopithecus millions of years ago. This is just a blip in history ago. Just as we were starting, we almost stopped. We almost didn't happen.
Right.
Apparently,
it was a super volcano. I think is the explanation that is thrown out the most.
Droughts. There were droughts that went on for tens of thousands of years, and probably a volcano was behind those. And you know, all kinds of species were suffering from it in Africa, but one of them, whose genes we've studied quite closely, was us. And yeah, we were almost wiped out by that catastrophe. It could very well have happened, and it didn't happen. We made it through, and everything else that followed, including civilization, including technology, including this show, right? I mean, all of our lives, everything that we know is due to the fact that we weren't wiped out. It's a good thing that 2,000 of us made it and that we started building our numbers up. So, you know, from where I sit, 7 billion people is great news. It's proof that that we've made it through, that, you know, we're that resilient. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just thinking, think how narrow that window is. 2,000 people, Phil. I mean, that's, you know, we were closer to going out than Battlestar Galactica, you know? I mean, we were.
Exactly.
We were
that's
on
a good,
the
that,
brink,
that is
man.
A good way of putting it. Yeah, Battlestar Galactica, they had like 30,000 people, right?
This I mean, they were doing great by comparison, you know? We just about bought it as a species.
Thank you for putting it in terms that we can all understand, Stephen. That's exactly right. You know, I mean,
You talk about and you know what else is fortunate? Cave girls are hot. That's fortunate. So.
Well, yeah. So it all worked out.
We got busy, and more people arrived, and there you are. So
thank goodness. Now, to me, it's unmitigated good news. There are concerns about how many people can fit on the planet, and we do have to be concerned about that. But to me, that concern should never be translated into tut-tutting someone else's existence, and that's why I chose the picture that I chose, the one that's if you're on our site, on our Blog Talk Radio site right now, or if you're looking at the Speculist, and I also put this up on Facebook, of a little girl who I chose as the 7 billionth resident of Earth, occupant of this planet. She's probably not really that because she's actually from a site that sells cute baby wallpaper, okay? I just grabbed a picture. I grabbed a cute baby picture, and this one caught my attention immediately because she looks astoundingly like my daughter. In fact, her mother saw that picture and said, "Where'd you get that picture of her?" And I'm like, "No, that's not our kid." I mean, that much like her. But to me, the challenge is this, okay? The people who want to wring their hands and say, "There's too many people, we've brought too many people onto the planet," I want you to be willing to go look that child in the eye and tell her that there's no room for her on this planet, right?
I'm going to tell you, there are a few jerks that are willing to do that. If you'll recall, Phil, we kind of have run Speculous sort of as in a very folksy manner, similar to the show.
Yes.
And so baby announcements were certainly not out of the question. So, when my fourth son arrived, of course, I made the announcement and everything on the Speculous. And remember, we had a commenter that basically said, "No, I don't think it's a good thing that you've had four kids. That's ridiculous. We're overpopulating the planet. Yada yada."
I forgot about that. That's right.
You remember that? Remember that? I think I forgot about that,
but I think that's the reason I now have four kids.
Just to show that jerk up.
Just
right?
To show that guy. That's right.
That's right. That's right. You had only had one at that time, and that's awesome, Phil. Thanks for not leaving me hanging there in the lurch, with four kids.
No, man, I got your six, dude. Always, I got your back. don't even worry about it. I'll have four more if you just whatever. Just tell me what you need. But
I think I'll stop at four. I think
there definitely are people who, that's pretty close, actually, when you tell somebody you've got too many kids. Although, again, he had the advantage of leaving a blog comment, which does somehow bring out the nasty in people.
It's a little bit more anonymous. You're not looking someone in the eye and telling them, you've overpopulated the planet.
Yeah,
he might
actually be big enough a jerk to actually look that little girl in the eye and say, "Nope, you don't get to stay. You don't get to be part of this planet. There's too many of us." And my point is, if there's too many of us, whoever's saying there's too many of us is one of us saying it. You know what I mean?
That's right.
If there's 7 billion and 7 billion is too many and you're one of the 7 billion, you can't point fingers. Right? You're here too.
Right.
I mean, it's like, well, okay, when I was born, there were only 3 billion. And if everybody had just stopped with me, we'd all be fine, right? But, what's to stop somebody from saying, "Well, no, 1.5 billion was the right answer. They should have stopped with me, and you shouldn't be here," right?
Let me ask this, Phil. My understanding is that developed nations are actually, for the most part, decreasing in population. The United States is a notable exception in that we're kind of, demographically sort of treading water. We're not growing or shrinking. We're sort of staying even. But most other developed countries, most of Europe, Japan, other places like that, they're having like a population crash. So, I mean, at what point do we expect to see sort of the population of the world as a whole just sort of either hold steady or begin to shrink?
One of the really interesting things that you'll see now is that no one pretends to have the answer on that anymore, which is great, because even 10 years ago there was some genius at the UN who would tell you exactly what the world population was going to be in such and such year. 2022 it'll be this, right? And 2050 it'll be this. Now
they're always
wrong.
wildly
well, yeah,
wrong.
I mean, you know, now they run different projections because they did not foresee exactly the phenomenon that you just described, which is that as nations become developed and as they reach a certain standard of living, they, you know, the rate of population growth slows tremendously. And in Western Europe and in Japan, it has actually started to reverse. They're not even reproducing at replacement level anymore. So the population there is actually expected to go down. And worldwide, the population of the world, the growth is slowing, such that I believe, is this right, the 7 billion, we reached it. It took us longer to get to 7 billion than it did to 6. And that's the first time we've hit a new billion that took longer than the one before. So that's that right there, evidence of the slowing. And it'll take longer to get to 8 billion than it did to 7 because, again, it's slowing down.
Well, probably it's sort of an S-curve. It's an S-curve, and we're beginning to reach the knee of that top of the top of the S-curve there.
Exactly.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, you know, who would really have the chutzpah to say for sure, right? I mean, you've really got to have a lot of confidence to say, no, it's going to work out like this. I mean, right now the evidence seems to indicate that it's slowing, that the rate of growth is slowing. I don't know that it then completely levels off. Maybe it continues to grow more slowly. Maybe it speeds back up. Maybe we really do start to face a future where there are fewer people on the planet than, you know, 7.5 billion may turn out to be the ultimate peak. That might be the most people we ever have. And 500 years from now, maybe there's only 3 billion, again, living on the planet. I think to a certain extent, it's anybody's guess. There are so many factors in play, particularly when you look at accelerating technology, when you look at all the things that we talk about on this show. There are so many factors that can make the population go up. There are so many factors that could make population growth rates slow. There are so many factors that could potentially make the population go down. I mean, one of the reasons that the U.S. is growing fairly rapidly, you pointed out that we're not actually producing children at a rate that makes our population grow. But the reason that our population is growing pretty fast is because we got a lot of people moving to the U.S.
Yeah,
so
not a bad place to live.
Yeah, yeah. Our population of our country is growing because people come live here.
Yeah.
What happens if in a couple centuries the population of this planet starts to go down because people go live someplace else? Right. That's an entirely possible scenario in the near term, you know, reasonable term future. So there's so many factors to consider that I don't think that I don't think it's really safe to make a projection. But all of the current projections do show it slowing down. Go ahead.
Our visions of the future have changed, though. Imagine. You know, the movie Soylent Green would not be made hardly today, would it? I mean, the vision of the future where we're just literally overrun with people, you can't even get up to your second floor apartment without having to step over the bodies in the hall, you know, that's no longer really, you know, I haven't seen a movie with that vision of the future, you know, since the 70s. Have you, Phil? I mean, perhaps there is. There have been a few, but
that really dystopic future, I mean, no. The closest would be in the 80s, maybe with Blade Runner, right? It wasn't as bad, but it was.
But, you know, Blade Runner, I mean, people are, you know, a lot of the people are leaving for the colony.
That's true.
You know,
yeah,
they
started
colony.
Making that migration. I mean, it's true. Our even our dystopic futures have gotten cleaner and prettier and less grim since the 70s. I think that whole population bomb scenario, the Paul Ehrlich scenario, has so lost credibility. I think all the Malthusian projections of the world have been discredited. Nobody really buys it, or at least it doesn't make a story that we want to tell anymore. Anyway, from a science fiction standpoint,
yeah.
I think there are probably still plenty of Malthusians around, and there are probably still plenty of Ehrlich devotees. And speaking of him, I was scrambling before the show. I wanted to find. Somewhere I've got an essay by do you read P.J. O'Rourke at all?
What is that author known for?
Well, his most famous book, I think, is probably Parliament of Whores. He explains the U.S. government. he used to be a columnist for Rolling Stone, and he's this really interesting guy. He was like a hippie in the 60s, and he became like a staunch conservative in the 80s. But he... he wrote an essay about the book, The Population Bomb. I think it was kind of a review of that book, and he just fisks it. I mean, he just totally deconstructs it. And I was looking through my books, I could not find it. There was a passage from it I really wanted to read because I thought it was very telling. But there is a section here I want to read, and this is the first words from Ehrlich's prologue to the book, The Population Bomb. Okay, here's your Soylent Green right here.
Okay.
The battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, he wrote this in the early 70s, so he's predicting the decade to come. He probably wrote it in the late 60s, and it was published right in the early 70s. In the 1970s, the world will undergo famine. Hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death in spite of any crash program embarked upon now. At this late date, nothing can prevent a substantial increase in the world death rate. And now O'Rourke summarizes. Dr. Ehrlich gives us several predictions. In his best-case scenario, America in 1974 stops food aid to India, Egypt, and some other countries, which it considers beyond hope. There's mild food rationing in the United States. The Pope approves birth control and abortion. Famines and food riots sweep Asia, ditto Africa, Latin America, and the Arab world, plus plagues and warfare. Russia has a lot of internal problems. Diebacks continue until 1985. What's left of the world sets a global population of 2 billion for the year 2025 and 1.5 billion for 2100. So that was
crash.
That. And you know what I love? The next sentence is the next paragraph in the book. O'Rourke notes, he was right about Russia. They had internal problems. Yes, okay, well, that part was true. Basically, I don't know how a person could get it any more wrong than he did, right? I mean,
right.
We were going to be down to 2 billion by the year 2025 after these massive plagues and starvation struck the earth, 40 years ago, back in the 30 years ago, back in the 70s. Great scenarios with the Pope approving birth control and approving abortion, people desperately trying to fend off this wave of hunger sweeping the planet, and none of it ever happened. Now, Paul Ehrlich, we've talked about in another context. Obviously, he is the man who had the famous bet with Julian Simon, author of one of my all-time favorite books. It's in my top, I'm going to say, three all-time favorite books. It's getting better all the time. Julian Simon placed a bet with Paul Ehrlich right around the same time frame as he was writing The Population Bomb, predicting that the price of certain minerals would, Ehrlich said they would all go up. He said they would all go down. Simon won the bet. The world has become a much richer, a much healthier, much safer, much cleaner place where material goods are much more abundant than they were in the 70s, with a lot more people than Ehrlich ever would have imagined living here. Much to his, I'm sure, chagrin, although it doesn't seem to slow him down, he continues to make wildly inaccurate statements. And this is the part that kills me. He continues to be taken completely seriously, and he is a man who is to this day quoted in the media, and he's a go-to guy, right? He's one of the guys.
Isn't he working in the Obama administration?
He may be. That's a good question.
I believe he is. I believe he is. And that's just it's like some ideas die hard, and Paul Ehrlich's ideas among a certain group of intellectuals, that idea dies hard. Even when he's been shown over and over to be wrong about it.
Goes to the respectability of pessimism, okay?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm betting at the same time that that Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb, somebody somewhere had a draft of a book. They probably couldn't even sell it, but a book describing an abundant world, with a big population and people getting richer, right? Some proto-Kurzweil back there in the 60s. And the idea couldn't even take hold back then. I mean, The Population Bomb became a huge bestseller, and it's still to this day, oddly enough, referred to as some kind of classic of understanding global dynamics. Even though again, and I don't think he can say this enough, he couldn't have got it more wrong than he did. And this swings us back to our discussion of life extension, because this is one of the issues that Sonia talks about in 100 Plus, and it's something that Peter Thiel talks about in the foreword that he wrote to 100 Plus. I remember right when you first got the book, before you had even really read the book, you were already singing the praise of the book based on Peter Thiel's introduction to the book.
Oh yeah, great introduction.
Peter Thiel, he really gets it, and he nails it on the fact that we are way too accommodating to death. I think we're far too accommodating to death, and we're far too accommodating to negativity and pessimism as a culture.
Well, our whole society is built around death. You know, it's built around the idea that, you know, we're born, we grow up, and we have institutions for, you know, for educating people while they're young, and then they get older and they take a career and they raise their own kids and their kids go off to school and then they begin the wind down, and you know, they might have you know, have a burst of creativity perhaps at the end, maybe not, and
right.
Then they just get sick and they die, and that's
right.
And our whole society is built around that. That's the whole cycle, you know. It's the circle of life, right? Well,
the circle of life,
you know,
yeah.
So that's the deal, and so that's why, I mean, talk about ideas dying hard. The idea of death is going to die hard, at least for some people. So,
well, and in fact, you know, it is the other side of the same coin. We're talking, we seem to be talking about two different topics here, but we're actually talking about exactly the same thing. And as you were talking, as you were describing that sequence, it reminded me of a big controversy we had here in the state of Colorado. Gosh, this might have been, it was around an election year. It might have been 88. It might have been 92.
I remember this. I know exactly what you're talking. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was Governor Lamb. He was an ex-governor at the time. But he made a speech in which he described, and this was his quote, "We have a duty to die. We have a duty to die and, you know, get out of the way and make room for the next."
You know who said almost the exact same thing?
Who?
The person who said almost the exact same thing was Steve Jobs in his otherwise brilliant Stanford speech.
Hmm.
He said almost the exact same thing. You know, we have, you know, that's what it's all about, is clearing the slate for the next person to come in and be brilliant. You know, and quite frankly, though, I mean, Steve Jobs, though, did his very best to battle the disease, didn't he?
He did absolutely. He in the end, if he believed he had a duty to die, he was shirking his duty at the end, and
yeah.
Good for him. Because, Sally, to answer your question, yes, that was Governor Lamb, Dick Lamb, who said that. And it's utter nonsense. Now he was misquoted. He was misquoted, and he got a lot of flack because. He was quoted as saying, "You have a duty to die," and what he said was, "We have a duty to die." So there is a slight difference there, and you know, I can see a distinction between telling a group of people, you know, "You guys all have to go die," and saying, "This is something that belongs to all of us." But ultimately, you can't say "we have one" without saying "you have one." I mean, you're telling other people that they have to die, and it's the exact same quandary. I think ultimately. It's that quote from Stalin, where if one person dies, it's a tragedy. A million die, it's a statistic, right? So people who are perfectly comfortable going, "Oh, Lord, population, we don't need all these people. There should be fewer people," in the abstract, I think would have a very hard time telling a little girl that she doesn't get to stay on the planet, that she must not be, right?
Or even their 90-year-old grandmother.
Or
you know,
tell their own grandma to her face that she's got to go now, right?
Yeah,
whole,
that's right. Their grandma, who they've loved all their lives, you know, and who's lived a nice long life. Nobody goes up to that grandma and say, "Grandma, you know, you've just been around too long."
Yeah,
you know, we all love
out.
Our grandma.
It's our turn,
you know?
Right? Can you imagine saying that? It's our turn now,
no.
Grandma. It's time for us to live. So, you know, I mean, nobody would ever say that. Those are the kinds of things you can only think in the abstract. No, as soon as you apply them to real people. You know, only a monster would actually apply them to real people. And that's the problem, okay, for people who want to freak out about 7 billion, is we're talking about 7 billion people. Okay?
Right.
You know, we're talking about
individual
7 billion
people,
babies and grandmas, okay? They're,
that's right.
You know, they're people. just like each of us. So I get a little wound up on this one. It drives me crazy.
It makes good radio, Phil. Keep going, brother.
You know, I mean, Soylent Green isn't people. The 7 billion they are, okay? They're just like your kids. You know, they're
That's
just
right.
like the face you see in the mirror. That's the point. They're human beings who are just as valuable as any of us. If we really, that's what it calls into question. And that's why I wanted to find that that quote from P.J. O'Rourke, because if for some reason those people aren't as valuable, it kind of calls into question one of the basic tenets that we have as a civilization, which is that we're all worthwhile. Suddenly it's like, well, maybe. And some of the quotes from the population bomb, it really starts to sound a little sketchy, like maybe Indians aren't worth as much as we are, right? Because there's just too many of them, and they're kind of tripping all over each other. And you start to scratch your head, and you go, well, it's not like – and P.J. O'Rourke doesn't accuse Paul Ehrlich of being a racist. It's not like he's a racist or anything, but there's just something a little elitist about the idea that, because there's so many babies in Bangladesh that they just don't count anymore, right? That they don't matter the way a baby here does, or an old person there doesn't count the way an old person here does. And, the truth is they absolutely do. So, okay,
no.
I've wound through my diatribe. I wanted to include last week some music that I thought demonstrated two different attitudes about death. And the first of these is one of the great classics of rock and roll. Both of these songs, I should say, are from the greatest era of popular music in human history, which is my teenage years, right?
So, exactly.
It peaked with you, didn't it,
Phil? I mean,
exactly. The music never got any better than that. And I think that this first clip we're going to play, I think would probably be considered, one of the 20 greatest rock songs of all time. Would you agree with that?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Okay, so let's get it.
It was, yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
Wait a minute.
Okay, that's a great song.
That can't
too,
be it.
Did I mislabel them? I might have mislabeled them.
Maybe I did. Well, here, let's try that again. Let's try the. Here we go with the greatest.
Okay, so,
classic, but you know what they're doing? They're romanticizing death, right?
Well, I think there's something else that needs to be said first. Do you want to say it or should
okay.
I?
Okay, go ahead.
I heard some cowbell, but I needed more. Okay, just me.
Exactly.
I don't know about you, but I got a fever, and the prescription is more cowbell. Okay. this is a great song. I love this song. Don't get me wrong. Okay, Blue Oyster Cult. You know, this song speaks to me of my teenage years, and it's a terrific song. But come on. Yeah, seasons don't fear the reaper, nor do the wind, the sun, or the rain. We can be like they are. Come on, Mary, don't fear the reaper. It is apparently this call to disregard death as something to be concerned about and, in fact, get on board with death. There's a statement about 40,000.
It almost sounds like a creepy suicide pact, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean,
it does sound like a creepy suicide pact. Yeah, it starts talking about how many people die every day. We can be like they are, Romeo and Juliet, or Together in Eternity. We can be like they are. It's almost this anthem to death. Now, I will note, because poor guy has been putting up with this for years, that the guy who wrote the song, Donald Roser, never intended that. To him, the Reaper death, he's using it strictly as a metaphor for love, and he's talking about getting on, you know, falling in love. Okay, that there is an old like poetic saw about conflating love and death, of comparing the two together, and he's just saying this is a song about love. It's not really about death at all. I'm just using death as a metaphor for love. And my answer to that is, you failed. Okay, everybody thinks it's about death. Nobody thinks it's about love. But understood, you weren't trying to write a song about a suicide pact. So you know, he got a great song out of it. But I think most people who listen to it hear it as that. They hear it as an anthem to death, right? To let's get on board with death, right? It seems to, now again, if he was writing about love, it's okay that he did this. But he seems to glamorize it. He seems to make it powerful. He seems to make it attractive, seductive, something that we just, you know, really ought to be a part of. That we shouldn't hesitate about stepping into. And that's crazy. Okay, as rational beings, we know we don't behave that way unless there's something seriously psychologically wrong with us.
Right. Right.
You know, that we protect our own existence and we don't try to die. We try not to die. We kill ourselves only when things have gone, you know, terribly wrong, or we're risky with our lives only when things have gone terribly wrong. But for some reason, a song like that is a classic forever, and a song like this next clip, which was a big hit, it was a big hit, was kind of a flash in the pan, one hit wonder, and let's go ahead and. Let's rock this place out with some disco, Stephen.
All right.
You can just picture the glass disco ball and the lights, and I mean, isn't it just
Studio 50, whatever it was? Yeah.
Yeah. Although I will say, in defense of Patrick Hernandez, he was originally a rock artist before he produced that song, which became his one and only like mega hit. And there is some nice guitar work in there for disco. That does have some nice guitar stuff going on. So I'm defending it as best I can on musical grounds. But my real defense of it is that song makes me feel great. Okay, I love that song. And you know what? Patrick Hernandez has never had to explain that it was a metaphor for something else.
Yeah.
right. When he says, "I was born to be alive. It's good to be alive. It's good to be alive. It's good to be alive." We know exactly what he's talking about, right? And I think you can feel it in that song. Now, that is kind of the that's the 20%. I think we live in a culture that is about 80% Don't Fear the Reaper, right? And about 20% Born to Be Alive. And I don't know why that is, but I feel like we might be approaching a time when that needs to, if not flip, maybe that balance needs to change a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, I think one thing that's going to help it along is when we actually have the technology to prolong our lives, you know, significantly longer than, I mean, we're inching up little by little, even now, aren't we, Phil? I mean, when I was born into a world where, you know, pretty much 70 was ancient, you know,
right.
I mean, really, really old. If you made it that, then that you were doing really good. You know, now I mean, pretty much, you know, provided you take halfway decent care of yourself, you know, you can kind of expect to live to be 80. I believe is it 80 now for men in the United States? I know
roughly,
it's over 80. It's over 80 for women. And so, you know, average age, that's life expectancy from birth. And so, obviously, the people that are closer to that age, their expectancy is longer. So, you know, it's things are changing already. But you know, it seems to me that when we're able to stay healthy and productive and active and everything, significantly longer, perhaps the average life expectancy is over 100. Then I think we have to start looking at things a little bit differently. Our institutions have to change. You know,
I think so. I think our attitude has to change, and you know, at the cultural level. I mean, we're referring to pop culture here, but you're right. Ultimately, the institutions will change because people are going to be older. But this kind of core driving belief in this kind of acceptance of the idea of the circle of life or a duty to die or any of that nonsense. I think it gets weaker. To your point. As our prospects grow, and my advice, my clarion call to everyone is, you know, let's not wait until the lifespan is 150 years. Let's get positive about being alive right now, because right now is when we are alive. And you know, we may yet make it to 150. Who knows? Making it to 80 from where many of us are right now might actually be a ticket to 150. It's a little bit hard to predict at this point. But why don't we adopt the attitude of people who have an indefinite lifespan, since we don't know for sure that we don't.
That's right. And live to see it, right?
You know, that's a good note to close on, Stephen. We've had a little bit of music here in the last few minutes. What's our actual music for the evening?
Well, the band name is, they're following Lynyrd Skynyrd in naming themselves, obviously, after someone they don't like. The name of the band is Brad Sucks. and the name of the song is Making Me Nervous.
Make Me Nervous by Brad Sucks. All right, Stephen, thanks for putting that together. Thanks to all of you for listening to Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week. We hope you'll be able to join us. And until then, live to see it. Taking your time.
Come on, man.